They are my bulwark against the terror. They are the defenders of humanity. They are my space marines, and they shall know no fear. The First Legion's Astartes. Stark and uncompromising, the Dark Angels were the first of the Emperor's legions, and the truest to the mold from which the Legion's Astartes had been struck. They were killers of the purest and most refined kind, for whom there could be no other destiny but a lifetime of war and death in the name of the Imperium and mankind. They did not build empires, made no attempt to master the ways of peace or the subtle skills of the artist, craftsman, or diplomat. They offered no excuses for their nature and made no compromises in the pursuit of their assigned duty, shirking neither the price they paid in blood nor that paid in infamy and solitude. Their greatest battles are to be found in no catalogue of compliance or roll of honor. No scholars or poets sing of these glories or remember those fallen in their prosecution. For they fought against foes so monstrous that it was deemed necessary that all mention of them be erased from history. Such was the nature of their service, not only to be prosecutors of the Great Crusade, but also to serve as the Imperium's most potent bulwark against the unknown terrors that lurked in the dark between the stars. The heraldry of the Dark Angels proclaims their lineage as the first of the Emperor's Legion's Astartes. But other than that simple fact, little is known of the origins of the Legion and its initial gene stock. What is known with some certainty is that of all the many breeds of these post-human warriors, the Dark Angels were conceived by the Emperor as a template for those that would follow, distilled from the gene code of the most stable of all his Primarchs, and without any attempt to foster specific traits or curb the eccentricities of the stock from which they sprang. The diversity of their origins brought a wealth of disparate martial traditions into the fledgling legion. During the early years of the Great Crusade, they were among the largest and most heavily armed of all the legion's Astartes. They fielded more warriors under arms, maintained a larger fleet, and had access to weaponry more powerful than any of their brother legions at that time. They learned and specialized in all forms of war, and their knowledge was passed on to the other legions. They won countless victories for humanity in this formative age. The most notable, perhaps, being the Rangdan campaigns, wherein more than 80,000 of the Legion's Astartes and uncounted millions of the Imperial Army gave their lives to hold back the hordes of the Xenos Rangda and their cohorts, preserving the fledgling Imperium from utter destruction. It was during this time that the Legion was to be reunited with its Primarch, Lion L. Johnson. The Dark Angels maintained a secretive and esoteric schema of heraldry and rank, each warrior being a member of an order, an organization of warriors which transcended legion structure, and a wing, as well as, in some cases, several other internal circles or councils outside of the traditional legion hierarchy. In the days before the coming of the Lion, the ranks of the First Legion were organized into six hosts, known as the Hexagrammaton, each with its own combat specialities and tactical doctrines, developed by veterans of the Legion over long campaigns. Later, after reuniting with their Primarch, these hosts would be refined and reorganized to become the six wings of the Dark Angels. The wings were structures which sat outside of Legion rank, created such that warriors of many disciplines were available to respond to the need for their expertise in any war zone. The Storm Wing incorporated the majority of the Dark Angels line infantry, training battalions and mobile ordnance batteries within its ranks. The members of this wing were drilled in the discipline and stalwart arts of close order warfare and set piece battles, unshakable in defense and resolute in attack. Its veteran warriors were the core of the Legion's infantry companies, capable of executing complex maneuvers and formations under the heaviest of enemy fire. When the Legion took to the field of battle en masse, the veterans of the Storm Wing stood in the front ranks, serving to steel the resolve of their brethren and to oversee the execution of orders in the chaos of battle. The Death Wing excelled in special operations alongside other units of the Legion, especially as a counterpart to the more numerous Storm Wing, with a multitude of sub-disciplines within its ranks. Most renowned among its specialists were those dedicated to the role of line breakers, elite veteran infantry who served to shatter the enemy's formations and create openings for other units or wings, and the lifeguard cadre deployed to protect officers during battle. These lifeguards were especially prominent, with few high-ranking officers in the Legion lacking a small force of Deathwing veterans sworn to give their lives to ensure their safety. The Raven Wing were based around the principles of mobile attacks, of strike and fade tactics, and skirmish warfare, and excelled at the use of light skimmers and aircraft, but also incorporated significant infantry assets. These were mostly reconnaissance squadrons, though among those were infantry units specialized in the use of drop pods and other orbital assault doctrines. When the Legion gave battle to a foe that sought to evade or confuse them, or one whose overwhelming power compelled them to counter it with speed, it was the warriors of the Raven Wing that took to the fore. The Dreadwing are perhaps the most feared of all the branches of the Hexagrammaton, garnering a reputation that far outweighed the wing's influence within the Legion. The Dreadwing was composed of those whose role was the utter annihilation of the enemy, the salting of the earth, and breaking of worlds. When called out from the ranks, The initiates of the Dreadwing were experts in the brutal tactics of massacre, purge, and the deployment of Exterminatus-class weaponry. Though many also specialized in the use of terror as a weapon. The Iron Wing was dedicated to the use of overwhelming firepower on the field of battle, to confound the foe by means of barrage and conflagration, to defy their riposte with inviolate armor, and carry the day by means of force alone. It was not a subtle wing, composed as it was of the majority of the Legion's armored vehicles, heavy dreadnoughts, and field artillery batteries. They excelled at the breaking of fortresses by superior firepower, and the rapid onslaught of massed war engines to overrun and annihilate an unprepared foe in the open field. The Fire Wing was the smallest of the six wings of the Hexagrammaton, dedicated to all the bloody subtleties of warfare. It was the hidden blade of the Legion, the knife in the dark, and the blade against the throat of the foe's commanders. Within its ranks were found to be an eclectic mix of stalkers, champions, and Morattat killers, all bound by their shared expertise in the arts of blade and knife, duelists and assassins without peer. The Primarch, Lionel Johnson, was reared upon the dark, forested world of Caliban, and it was from the planet's culture that the Dark Angels draw many of their nightly traditions. Located to the far galactic north of Terra, close to dark and warp-tainted regions of space, Caliban was a planet of vast primal woodlands and savage great beasts, which preyed upon the feudal peoples of its lands. Before the Emperor was reunited with his lost son, Lionel Johnson had risen to command a great knightly order and had become a master of its military. A superlative and tempered warrior, the Lion took his place at the head of the First Legion, bestowing upon them the name Dark Angels, and found acceptance with his brother Primarchs. Despite this honored place, the Lion remained apart, for though his strategic skill and talent with a blade rivaled that of Horus himself, the secretive mien of the Dark Angels and Johnson's own taciturn nature often led to distrust. Nonetheless, the Lion proved his ability many times over during the Great Crusade. And even when the title of War Master was given to Horus, his devotion to the Emperor did not falter. It was during the Great Crusade that another momentous event would shape the destiny of the Lion and his Legion. In the midst of the Doolin campaign, the impetuous nature of Leman Russ came into direct conflict with the meticulous tactics of Lionel Johnson. When the Lion claimed a kill which Russ considered his own, the two Primarchs came to blow. The two legions would become rivals, but also close brothers in arms. Both were relied upon by the Imperium to vanquish the most terrible of foes, entrusted beyond all others to enact the grim will of the Emperor when the utter destruction of a foe's works and worlds was required. The Third Legion's Astartes. The legionaries of the Emperor's children have always strived to be exemplars above all others in the arts of war. Paragons of martial virtue and excellence, scorning those who did not meet their standards. This led them to seek perfection in war as a fluid, lightning-quick force whose battles were preordained victories, brought about by a combination of acute strategic planning and flawless execution. Always they sought greater challenges, against which to prove themselves and attain greater glories in turn. From this vaunted height, the Third Legion would descend into treachery and become the lowest and most vile of creatures, enslaved to pride and consumed by desires that no natural power could fulfill. The history of the Legion's deeds before its fall is not simply a history of what it was and what it achieved, but a history of how it created its own doom. For as the ancient texts say, pride goeth before destruction. And seldom has this proverb been more apt than in the case of the Third Legion. Terran recruits for the Third Legion were drawn from the noble houses of Europa, forming an aristocratic brotherhood bonded by martial pride. The Legion's gene seed was free from flaw, and its warriors were given to a competitive spirit, eager to prove their individual superiority. The nascent Third Legion was deployed not in mass like its brother legions, but in smaller cadres, leading Imperial Army regiments, allowing its legionaries to prove themselves as natural leaders with a superb ability to execute the intent and exceed the expectations of the Emperor in war. The noble bearing of the Third Legion's warriors made them ideal diplomats and emissaries, often afforded the honor of carrying the Emperor's standard. None were honored more highly by the Master of Mankind, for after a cohort of the Legion sacrificed themselves to shield him during the betrayal at Proxima, they were given the exclusive right to bear the Emperor's sigil, the Palatine Aquila, and he named them his children. Though the Emperor's children earned huge renown, their superlative rise was not to last. Just as the Great Crusade was beginning, the Legion suffered a tragic gene seed crisis, through which treachery and viral blight, its reserves of gene seed dwindled beyond replenishment, withering to a shadow of the force it once was. Attrition bled the strength of the Legion to almost nothing. With only 200 warriors remaining, so few that each carried the banner of a perished company, on the very brink of extinction, the Legion was reunited with its Primarch and saved. In the Third Legion, every warrior was placed into a function best suited to their ability. Fulgrim maintained rigid order amongst the divisions of his legion and command hierarchy, which were then divided into strict lines of authority, with 30 lord commanders below the Primarch, of whom the first 10 were exalted as princes of war, forming Fulgrim's inner circle. Each Lord Commander led a chapter named a Millennial, and authority descended through an elaborate and multi-tiered command structure, from company praetors down, with each Space Marine looking to his superior devoutly for leadership in a manner that bordered on a cult of personality. At their height, the 30 Millennials numbered 110,000 warriors. Though in the wake of the Istvan campaign, it is believed to have been reduced to roughly half, only recovering by the eve of the Siege of Terra through accelerated implantation and indoctrination procedures. Honors were common, but were gifted rather than assumed, and those granted by the hand of the Primarch were held in the highest esteem. Every warrior knew his place and value, and this translated into a level of personal commitment and bravery, fueled in no small part by an unshakable faith in their own superiority. The Emperor's children believed there was no sphere of warfare in which they could not excel. Though they never possessed the numbers or the mindset to engage in brute attrition warfare, and so their primary consideration was to keep the Legion as intact as possible while achieving victory. One of their chosen virtues was lightning warfare, for they believed that speed and decisiveness assured victory over strength and endurance. Moreover, Fulgrim himself preferred swift and elegant combat styles, and many companies of the Legion adopted large numbers of jetpack-equipped assault units, jet bikes, and land speeders. The emphasis on excellence led to the formation of a number of unique elite and specialized units, such as the Sun Killers, las cannon-equipped squads formed from the cream of the Legion's heavy weapon specialists, or who fulfilled more formal roles such as the Phoenix Terminators, Fulgrim's Praetorians, whose number was set at 200 in memory of the first days of the Legion's rebirth. Single combat was encouraged as a primary martial tradition, the duel seen as the ultimate expression of a warrior's prowess. So highly regarded were the blade masters of the Emperor's children that a semi-formal formation was allowed to develop whose membership existed outside of the rigid rank structure, that of the Brotherhoods of the Palantine Blades, who formed only for battles against foes deemed worthy of their attention. In war, the Emperor's children relied greatly on peerless strategic planning and the flawless execution of battle plans by individual warriors. Every aspect of battle was analyzed and turned to advantage, from terrain and weather to logistical support and reinforcement. Nothing was left to chance. This almost mechanistic approach to warfare had its dangers as well as its strengths, however, and should an entirely unforeseen contingency occur, or some crucial element or asset be unexpectedly removed, the Legion could be wrong-footed and thrown into confusion. However, for the most part, the strict and sure chain of command and the legionaries' attention to detail and individual skill allowed them to execute some of the most complicated, multi-tier combined arms feats of any legion during the Great Crusade. In the last years of the Great Crusade, the pursuit of excellence became an arrogant assumption of superiority, a collection of laurels more important than imperial unity. It is likely that the overweening pride that had come to dominate the Legion's senior commanders forced them to walk the path of the traitor rather than to accept the role of servants in a unified and peaceful Imperium. To become reduced to one amongst many was a fate that pride could not endure. During the Age of Darkness, the practiced excellence of the Emperor's children was a brittle facade that concealed a swiftly growing canker. At the heart of the Third Legion, Fulgrim and his Lord Commanders partook of sordid feasts and abhorrent bacchanals that defied both decency and sanity. With their leaders languishing in decadence, the Legion fragmented, many of its commanders blaming one another for their lack of perfection and settling matters of honor in bloody duels. And as Fulgrim sank into madness, his legionaries followed, making of themselves fearsome instruments of terror in the process. Fulgrim's homeworld, the long-forgotten Kimos, was a gray-skied and gray-skinned mining world, where hope was thin and drudgery the coin of life. Privation was common on Kimos, and the isolated human population that abided there suffered slow decay. Despite all these hardships, Fulgrim rose quickly to power. Compared to the wretches that breathed the slow poison of Kimos' polluted atmosphere, Fulgrim was pale-skinned and fine-boned, like some ancient paragon of grace given life. Ash-white hair framed a handsome face, and his violet eyes held a spark of delight. Fulgrim inspired hope with his intellect, his mien, and his practiced humility in respect of his own brilliance. Once reunited with his legion in war, thought, craft, and creation, he excelled effortlessly. He reorganized the Emperor's children in a manner that suited his own exacting nature. Nothing was left to whim or chance. Everything was deliberate and assessed for its aesthetic and functional value. Fulgrim was fond of remarking that if one was to excel, then no detail was too small to consider, and that the quality of the whole lay in the quality of its constituents. In ordering his legion, it is not surprising, then, that Fulgrim favored formality, conformity, and order, albeit with some leeway for flair. He sought to maintain the majesty of his legion, recruiting from the ruling elite worlds brought to compliance. He was a being who reveled in the beauty of art, music, and poetry, insisting that those around him were more than just warriors, but artisans of the finest aspects of humanity. Fulgrim's only flaw was his pride, and it is among the greatest tragedies of the Horus Heresy that one of the Emperor's most noble paragons would be corrupted through his weakness and brought from the height of glory to the basest nadir of degeneracy. The Fourth Legion Astartes. The Fourth Legion was the cold-hearted battering ram of the Great Crusade, a maul used to tear down every impregnable fortress or unassailable citadel that dared stand in the path of the Emperor's will. The Iron Warriors became a byword for relentless, punishing warfare, and for mastery in siegecraft, both in defense and assault. They took no pleasure in their duty, nor did they shirk from it. They saw war only in terms of cold logic, ensuring that the arithmetic and calculus of bodies and machines sent into the meat grinder was always made to balance in their favor. Defeat was anathema to the Legion, and victory worth any price paid in blood. The 4th Legion was ever dutiful, ever reliable, but never lauded. It was a legion deserving of every glory enjoyed by its brothers, but time and again was overshadowed. A shining blade blunted in the mud of 100 worlds. During the long, grueling years the Legion spent on campaign, its warriors became embittered and distrusting of the Great Crusade which they served, and resentment festered in their hearts. From its inception, the 4th Legion's gene seed was highly adaptable, and rates of implant rejection were low. This meant that the 4th strength was built rapidly, expanding to several full battalions, while other nascent legions were little more than company musters. In turn, the 4th Legion was swiftly put to active service. Thanks to its gene seed, it was the most numerous legion in the first years of the Great Crusade, and its forces were split between several of the first expeditionary fleets. The 4th quickly proved itself in battle, and for a time, ranked highly upon the honor rolls of the Imperium. It was large enough to remain autonomous from the influence of the newly found Primarchs, and remained stubbornly regimented in structure and doctrine. The Legion earned a reputation of approaching each enemy with an unaltered pattern of warfare, facing it down with relentless and meticulously applied force alone, rather than cunning or heroics. This was a double-edged blade, for as other legions attained their own characters, they looked down upon the 4th as unimaginative, mechanistic, or even honorless. Conversely, to the Great Crusade's high command, these traits were desirable, making the 4th more reliable and more ready to accept command without complaint. The 4th Legion could be split into contingents as needed by theater commanders without the obstacle of a Primarch, and never balked in their duties. Accordingly, the 4th Legion was increasingly used to fighting inglorious but vital campaigns of drawn-out, back-breaking war, and was directed by the hands of others to dangerous garrisons, becoming a workhorse legion, relied upon not for any unique ability, but simply to follow orders. Over time, the Legion was exploited, bled through thankless attrition, outpaced in glory, and made resentful. It was to this damaged and disabused Legion that Perturabo came. Within the 4th Legion, Perturabo's word was law, and all his warriors were grist for the bloody mill of war. Promotion and advancement in the Legion's ranks was a matter of survival, both from the enemy and Perturabo's displeasure, and of specialization. Honorifics and commendations meant little to the Iron Warriors. However, the the high rank of warsmith, was awarded to the truest masters of the battlescape, amongst whom three were promoted to Perdurabo's council, the Trident. The principal strategic building block of the Iron Warriors was the Grand Battalion. This formation had a notional strength of 1,000 Space Marines, but it also incorporated armor and artillery. Recruitment and reinforcement into a Grand Battalion was continuous to offset high attrition rates, causing strengths to fluctuate wildly. Organization below the strategic level varied by the demands of particular deployments, with common divisions rated as infantry cohorts or heavily mechanized grand companies. Below this were the line centuries, comprising roughly 100 legionaries and a large complement of armor. A system of orders existed outside of the Legion's main structure. Most renowned were the Stor Bazaak, masters of siege and ordnance, even among a Legion specialized in such tactics, and the Iron Havocs, marksmen of the most powerful weapons a legionary could carry unassisted. The Tyranthikos, or Siege Tyrants, were veteran linebreakers equipped with Terminator armor. There also existed a series of warrior societies outside of the Legion's command structure, such as the Dodecatheon, an order of competing masons and strategists in the arts of siegecraft. The Apollochron, those who experimented with the machine craft of battle automata. The Kelidakos, master shipwrights. And the Lysatra, known as the Brethren of Thunder, or disparagingly as the Burned Men, whose obsession with devastation exceeded what the Legion considered practical. At every level, the Iron Warriors Legion was formidably provisioned. The Legion took a practical approach using equipment selected foremost for reliability and ease of repair, function taking precedence over form. Of note was the huge number and diversity of armored vehicles and artillery support assets fielded by the Iron Warriors, which were regarded as almost disposable owing to the Legion's capacity to quickly replace such assets. Its munitions and armor reserves were also estimated to exceed that of several other legions combined. Perdurabo demanded that his legion would be a peerless engine of war. He rebuilt it in his own design, and it operated as a cohesive, determined, and disciplined force. An army whose task was to overwhelm its foes by the most efficient methods possible, destroying utterly the enemy's ability to resist. The Legion was technologically proficient and preferred to strike always from a position of overwhelming superiority, bringing maximum force directly to bear. They favored use of massive, focused bombardments as a precursor to attack. The calculation of fields of fire, the use of high-intensity shelling, and the deployment of heavy armor and mechanized forces to spearhead assaults where the Iron Warriors stalk in trade. Under Perdurabo, the Legion's character was amplified. Where once the Legion had been ruthless in its willingness to accept losses in return for victory, Now it was utterly driven to the point where such considerations were far beneath it. The Legion's acceptance of mass casualties as the price for victory made it excel at siege warfare of the most vicious kinds. War became a deadly equation, which the Iron Warriors were supremely suited to solve. A relentless, unyielding engine of steel and fire, which swept worlds clean and devoured whole armies. The Iron Warriors suffered the highest casualty rates of any legion. Yet, through the cruel genius of Perturabo's calculus, it absorbed these mass losses without serious damage to its combat effectiveness. In a dark twist of fate, Perturabo would frequently expend the forces of the Exertus Imperialis as sacrificial cannon fodder to deplete the enemy's munitions or to simply gauge their strength before committing his legion. This tarnished the Legion's once pristine reputation with the War Council, and, as a consequence, relegated it to hopeless wars in forlorn corners of the galaxy, only furthering the growing bitterness of resentment felt by its warriors. Perturabo was a ruthless and effective warlord, a master strategist whose razor-edged mind could fathom the hidden weakness in any enemy and exploit it with savage and decisive action. His capacity for learning was incredible, and his intellectual curiosity insatiable. He was gifted above all others in scientific and technical intelligence. However, from the outset, he was a distant, calculating mastermind who cared not for others, nor readily deigned to explain his actions or intentions. This mattered little in the context of his use as a weapon for the Great Crusade. However, for Perturabo was formidable and could deconstruct and overcome any obstacle or cast down any foe. When united with his legion, he reviewed their record and their doctrines against the legions of his brothers, and found the fourth wanting. It was not enough for Perturabo that they were merely superior. Their failing was that amongst the legions they were not already supreme. His punishment was decimation, putting 1 in 10 of his legion's warriors to death. While outsiders were horrified by this seemingly wasteful action, to Perturabo, it was a calculated and cathartic act, purging his legion, and by extension himself, of the weakness which pervaded it, and proving to all that he was first amongst his brothers in ruthlessness, decisiveness, and willpower. The Fifth Legion Astartes. The warriors of the Fifth Legion were the pathfinders of the Great Crusade, ever forging a path through uncharted territory far beyond the borders of the expanding Imperium, and oft forgotten by the chroniclers that followed in the conquest's wake. Organized into small, mobile units, the Fifth Legion ran before the armies of the Emperor during the final conquests on Terra, and then across the stars, sowing confusion and death amongst their foes. They were the swift blade that probed for weakness before a sudden and deadly strike, not the sledgehammer that some of their brother legions had become. Theirs was the lightning that struck from clear skies and withdrew without a trace, leaving only ashes behind. The white scars were often overlooked and considered the outcasts of the Legion's Astartes. Operating so far from the Imperial Core and being so culturally distinct from the Terran norm, though alternatively disdained or unremembered by most, it would be the Fifth Legion that would overturn the scales of destiny itself. From their inception, the Fifth Legion were held apart from their brothers, rarely being found in massed ranks among the assembled hosts of the Unification Wars. Yet they were one of the first legions to draw blood in the name of the Emperor. Taken first from the techno-nomadic tribes of the Tulian Basin, whose hardy stock had traversed those icy wastes in vast mechanized crawlers throughout the long years of the Age of Strife, and later from the wider stock of Terran recruits, the warriors of the Fifth Legion were the Unification's eyes and ears. While some of the earliest legions were committed to the front lines of the initial conquest alongside the Emperor's Thunder Warriors, the Fifth Legion was granted the solitary duty of seeking out the hidden fastnesses of the many gene-wrought demagogues and warlords that ruled the war-ravaged face of old Earth. Always, they were pioneers, used in reconnaissance and sudden shock assault, and where they could not eliminate an enemy outright, they gathered information on the foe's strength and force disposition, acting as the vanguard for a reserve Imperial host. As the Emperor's war for galactic reconquest moved outward from Terra, the Fifth Legion moved ahead of the expeditionary fleets. For over half a century, the Fifth fought a lonely, piecemeal crusade, each of its companies separated by such distance that its flotillas slowly began to lose any sense of unity with their brethren. Each of these pioneer companies, their many acts of heroism beyond the leading edge of the Emperor's ever-expanding domain, garnered a little praise or attention amongst the lords of the Imperium. There, in the outer darkness, shorn of supply and reinforcement, was the basis of the White Scar's mastery of hit-and-run warfare established by necessity. For they simply could not afford to engage in protracted wars of attrition. The Fifth Legion has never adhered closely to the strictures of the Principia Bellicosa, a deviance which only grew under the command of the Great Khan. Lacking in the numbers that allowed many of the other legions to operate as fully fledged war hosts, the Fifth Legion was originally organized into small pioneer companies, each operating as a separate, fully autonomous and independent force. This independence of operation and command was both a necessity due to the size and mission of the early Fifth Legion, and a legacy of the fierce spirit of its original recruits. When the Great Khan took command of the Legion, he reformed these warriors into a number of flexible hordes, equivalent to groupings of a number of chapters. These formations stood above the brotherhood or company level in the Legion structure. In creating his new Legion, The Great Khan was careful to split up the old pioneer companies, mixing warriors of differing origins together with new recruits from his home world of Chagoras to constitute the new hordes. The other main organizational unit within the White Scars, the Brotherhood, was a unit roughly equivalent to the standard company. Just like the larger hordes, each brotherhood varied in size quite widely, with some being formed of less than a few hundred warriors, and others up to several thousand. Typical brotherhoods were almost always mechanized cohorts, in that the entire force of the brotherhood was either mounted on jet bikes or supplied with other forms of transport to enable rapid deployment and high-speed onslaught or pursuit operations. However, some specialized brotherhoods comprised dedicated artillery trains and slower-moving vehicles of war, or lighter skirmishing and reconnaissance units, the Legion remaining a flexible force able to prosecute any form of warfare. Most brotherhoods also included what the White Scars referred to as a keshig, which indicated a body of troops somewhere between a lifeguard for the Khan and an elite reserve intended to bolster both the fighting spirit and tactical firepower of the Lion troops. Given the overtly aggressive nature of most White Scar tactics, these units often formed the forefront of any assault, and most often contained the most skilled and experienced warriors within the Brotherhood. Several bodies of warriors also existed outside of the Brotherhood structure. These included the Dark Sons of Death, destroyer cadre warriors deployed in combat when the utter annihilation of the enemy was required, as well as for certain ritual roles in the wake of key campaigns. The Falcon's Claws served as hunters and forward scouts, experts in survival and quiet elimination of enemy commanders. The Kharash, less a formal order and more a temporary assembly of penitent or glory-seeking warriors, was assembled whenever the need for a divisionary or shock assault force arose. The Uhan Solban, omens of ill fate, comprised almost every one of the limited number of dreadnoughts in service with the White Scars. The Akoglanar was the Legion's expanded apothecarian. The White Scars also made use of so-called weather witches or storm seers, a cohort of battle psychers which was maintained even after the Edict of Nicaea. Jagatai Khan, the Warhawk, was reared upon the wild planet of Chagoras, a wilderness of sweeping plains, forests, and mountains. Its tribes fought constantly, though all would ultimately submit to the might of the Khan of Khans, as Jagatai came to be known. When the Emperor came to Chagoras and granted Jagatai domination over the Fifth Legion, he was still possessed of a Mian born of the vast wilderness. And despite having already mastered the strategies of conquest, Jagatai Khan was unfamiliar with the advanced technologies of the Imperium. Nonetheless, the Khan shaped his legionaries as he would the plains warriors of his home, testing his new sons in bloody trials and grueling contests of skill and strength. The Great Khan gave his disparate sons more than honor scars. He also introduced a united cultural identity to the Chagorian mold. He encouraged his legionaries to take pleasure in their duty and to study the noble pursuits as they were known on Chagoras, such arts as calligraphy, hunting, and the telling of ancient tales. He made the ways of Chagoras the truth of his legion. A strange blend of practicality and superstition that was ill at ease with the strict tenets of the imperial truth. Jagatai's refusal in later years to amend the practices and outlook of his legion to more closely fit the imperial truth was yet another source of conflict between the Great Khan and some of his brothers, notably zealous Lorgar and overbearing Gilliman. In every battle in which he fought, Jagatai led the assault. He was ever able to be found where the fighting was most intense. It was to Jagatai and to each other that each White Scar was bound, not to the distant dream of the Imperium or any one of its worlds, but only to the Khan of Khans and the savage joy he took in war and in life.